Thank you to the organizers for the opportunity to talk here. First of all, I would like to say that the idea of the talk is to present you with essentially why there is some excitement, part in the community of quantum information, part in the community of condensed matter, because some new ideas coming from quantum information seem to be helpful to address standing problems in other areas like condensed matter. So I will try to review why the problem is interesting and also make clear that a lot of effort has been put by many people from other fields. So I start by quoting my collaborators. The work I'm presenting here has been done with Guifré Vidal, who is now in Caltech, with Enrique Rico and Romano Luz. Roman is here. Enrique is a student. Both are students in Barcelona. Also with Kitaev, Alexei Kitaev in Caltech, and with Carsten Lutken at the University of Oslo. The talk will be organized as an introduction, very elementary. Then I will discuss the result, which is scaling of the entropy as a measure of entanglement in many qubit systems. And then I will move on to the idea of entanglement loss along free normalization group trajectories. So this is a roadmap, in a way. It's telling you that scaling of entropy is a meeting point of several fields. On one hand, you have high energy physics through the physics of black holes, where people have been discussing in the field of quantum gravity the problem of entropy, of information loss in the geometry of a black hole, in the quantum gravity setup. But as you will see, immediately on toy models, people address the problem of 1+1 dimensional field theories, which is dominated, or it is controlled by the representations of conformal field theory. On the other hand, in condensed matter physics, spin networks have been there for many, many years. We have techniques like density matrix renormalization group, DMRG, which were set up many, many years ago, decades ago, which are the state-of-the-art method to do numerical simulations. And then in quantum information, the idea of extending entanglement measures to many qubit systems have produced the natural goal of understanding entropy in those systems. And as you will see, it matches with the idea of efficient simulation. So I go there, and the first step is to understand that many of the measures of entanglement do not have the ingredient we want when we talk about many qubit systems. So if you have few qubits, you may discuss many. You can invent many figures of merit that tell you about entanglement. As you go to a few qubits, immediately you discover that there is a proliferation of possibilities, and it's difficult to understand which is better suited for what. Now, this is in clear contrast with many qubit systems, because many qubit systems typically are of interest if they are controlled by a physical interaction which is relevant in nature, a Hamiltonian, which is important. So, for instance, they typically are translational invariant. They typically are nearest neighbor couplings. So you do have the problem that addressing one particular qubit is of not that much interest. Actually, if you think for a second, any correlator, any, on a many qubit system, any correlator, call it operator O at psi I, an operator O at psi j, if you take the vacuum expectation value and you subtract the one-point correlators, this is the connected piece, typically this object is not zero. And we are talking about zero temperature systems. So that means that there is a correlation. That means that the vacuum is an entangled state. So we do have entanglement. Any correlator measures entanglement, any. But we also know that this is not enough. We want to characterize entanglement. So people have come with solutions. They have taken these correlators, and they discovered that at long distances, they decay with a power law and also modified by an exponential law at long distances. And they call these psi character, the correlation length. So that's a measure of entanglement. I mean, this is clear. This guy here, the power law, this is called a critical exponent or a scaling exponent. This is a correlation length. If the correlation length is infinite, the exponential disappears. We only have power laws. We say that the system is at a critical point because the correlations are long range. They cover all the system. They are not exponentially damped. Now, this is what we do have. You see, in this sense, what we are interested in is what is the behavior of our measure of entanglement as we change the distance, as we scan distances. That's why an idea like I've chosen one of them, concurrence, is good. But no question it measures something. But it is not on the spirit of analyzing the behavior of the system as you change the scale, which is what people want. Now, we do want something more than that. So why am I unhappy with that? I'm not unhappy. This is perfectly okay. But as you see, this measure of entanglement depends on the operator content of the theory. So if you do have spins, if you have some order parameter, some disorder parameter, it depends on that. So you need the previous knowledge of what is your theory. So it would be very nice to have a measure of entanglement which is independent of a priori knowledge of the model. So you really want something which is intrinsic to the state. So forget Hamiltonians, concentrate on the quantum state, and now provide a measure of entanglement. And this is the idea of the measure I will now discuss, which is the reduced density matrix entropy. So let's little by little construct. So this is very, very simple. I start with a chain. This could be a network, could be anything, which I split into two parts, A and B. I will take the Hilbert space to be the direct product of A and B, and I will write the Schmidt decomposition for the state. That is, I will first write the decomposition on any basis, and then I will take the tensor rank 2, and I will diagonalize it using two unitary transformations on each side, and I come to the diagonal form, and this I call the Schmidt decomposition. Chi, the Schmidt number, tell me something about entanglement. So, let's see. Indeed, if I take again my Schmidt decomposition, and chi is a Schmidt number, turns out that if I trace system B, then I get this density matrix for A. Therefore, it would be a pure state if P1 is 1 and the rest are 0. If P1 is not 1, therefore, I do have some entanglement. Good. A property that you will see is crucial in the next transparencies is that the reduced entropy that party A sees is identical to the reduced entropy of party B. This is a very old and clear result because it does not depend on the eigenvalues, but on the eigenvectors, but on the eigenvalues. And in particular, if you only have a qubit, you define the e bit, and the entropy is 1. Now, another property of this entropy, the reduced piece of the state, what is the entropy of that state, is that it has a maximum, which is n, and that it verifies the strong superadditivity theorem. Now, this strong superadditivity theorem has an immediate consequence. Take your system of qubits, here it is, and consider in this equation that P are L minus M qubits, and A and C are M. So here you take L minus M, and you take a little piece of M and M. You substitute here, and this is L minus M plus M, this is L minus M plus M. So you have twice SL, which is bounded by SL plus M minus SL minus M. And this is concavity. So we have learned that the reduced entropy is bounded by a line, and on top it must be a concave expression of the number of qubits. This comes simply from the strong superadditivity theorem. So there are constraints. Could I please ask you to remember that the maximum is n? Okay? That's a maximum you can have, n. Okay? So we go ahead. we are ready to define the measure of entanglement. Simply take a spin chain. You concentrate on L of those spins. You compute the reduced density matrix for the state. If this state is a ground state of a Hamiltonian, much better. If it is not, I don't care. Okay? Whatever state, I can perform this operation. And once I have that, I take the eigenvalues and I compute the entropy. SL is the entropy of the reduced density matrix. And that's a figure of merit, because now I will take L, I will scan the system. So you see, that was my dream. Have a figure of merit that would test different lengths in my... They are persistent. What is the fate of the correlations? So this is the idea. A few comments on this measure of entanglement. In a way, it is clear this is standard. Entropy measures the surprise. So why I expect this entropy to increase? Because, you see, I'm in my state. I forget about those spins. And now I include a new spin. So I'm checking L plus 1. As I increase to L plus 1, I may have correlations or not have correlations. If I don't have any correlation, I'm a product state with my next spin. The entropy remains constant. If I was entangled, and now I include a new spin, I got the surprise that I discover entanglement. So this entropy is increasing little by little as I enlarge my physical system. So first, it measures the surprise as I keep enlarging my view of the system. Second, you see, for a given theory, it is defined on the ground state, on the state. I do not need to know the Hamiltonian. No necessity. Hamiltonian contains much more information because it contains all the spectrum. Okay? I'm concentrating on one of the states. And then it scans scales, which is something we do want in many qubit systems. And, very important, this is a quantity that has been discussed in other fields. In particular, it has been discussed heavily in black hole entropy, as I will try to present here. It's related to quantum phase transitions. Its behavior, its scaling will be related to quantum phase transitions, and therefore, in spin chains, to conformal field theory, which is, again, a very well-developed field in the 80s. And it's peculiar enough, but there were no computations in condensed matter. So it was not used in condensed matter. So we need now to be more concrete. So we concentrate now on a spin chains. We take a physical system, and we will try to compute this abstract quantity and get exactly its behavior. So this is the famous XY model. As you see, it's a, if n goes to infinity, the number of qubits goes to infinity. This is a translational invariant Hamiltonian. It couples the spin operators of site L with site L plus 1, and it couples in different ways. So depending on the parameters of the Hamiltonian, we have different interactions. This is one of the nice things of the optical lattices, that we may be very near to simulate models which were invented as toy models of real physical systems. So we are closing a loop here. Now, this model, in the particular case of gamma equals 1, you see this term disappears, and this is known as the quantum Ising model on the transverse magnetic field. And it is one of the most studied models in the literature. And you also have an extension on the other side that is XX, YY, ZZ. And delta is a parameter of anisotropy, and this is called the Heisenberg model. You see, delta 0 corresponds to the XY. These models are well studied, and there is a phase diagram. So we know exactly, not exactly, we know how the theory looks in different regions of the parameter space. So, you see, lambda was the magnetic field. Here I'm enlarging the magnetic field. And gamma was the anisotropy between the XX and the YY interaction. So if I keep zero for gamma, which is the XX model, I know that all this region from 1 to minus 1, actually, is a symmetry here. This is a critical theory. We know that the correlators decay as power laws. They are defining quantum phase transitions. This model is at a quantum phase transition. If we enlarge gamma, it turns out that the plane becomes non-critical, and in particular, for the magnetic field equals 1, that's again the critical theory, and this is the critical Isaac model. Okay? Now, on this line, we have what is called a marginal deformation, is the XY critical, and away from it, the model is not critical. So all the correlators decay exponentially. All the correlators decay exponentially. In the language of a field theory describing these models, those are massive theories, and these are massless theories. Mm-hmm. The quantum phase transitions we are discussing are called quantum phase transitions because they take place at zero temperature. See, it's not a thermal phase transition, it's a quantum phase transition. So what makes the correlators not to vanish is entanglement, not a classical superposition of different energy states. We are at the quantum phase transition, no temperature here. Now, there are now three transparencies just to show you that how the details of the computation look, but I'm not really pretending to go through the details. So just that you have the picture of what kind of computations you do. This is your Hamiltonian. These are your sigma operators, your Pauli operators. And the way you proceed is, you see, you go back to the techniques developed in the 60s, which is to you define a non-local transformation that makes that at every site you have a degree of freedom that anti-commutes everywhere. Now look that this guy obeys peculiar commutation relations, because away from the same point they commute, in the same point they do not. Now we want something which is universal like this. And in order to get this kind of operators, you need the Jordan-Wigner transformation, which is very useful in one dimension. Now, after you do that, your Hamiltonian reads bilinear, but still you need to take advantage of translational invariance. And after that, you need to make a little rotation for every momentum mode, which is called a Bogoliubov transformation. Once this is done, the model is diagonalized. You have the energy spectrum. And you can explicitly build a ground state, because once you have this function, for some values it is positive, for some other values it is negative, and the ground state is produced very simply. You say, for those modes which is negative, I populate them, so I simply say that they are like that. If I'm here, I use the destruction operator, so I do like that. And the vacuum is defined depending on the mode k that you populate or you do not populate. Now, once you know the vacuum, you can reconstruct all the correlators, and it's an effort, but you do it. As I said, let's not enter in this. And you can compute the reduced density matrix. Again, it's a technical point, but let me just say that because the Hamiltonian has reduced to a Gaussian theory, we are in good shape. It's a free theory. It's Gaussian. It's very simple. So it turns out that in those momentum modes, there is no interaction. So it's a diagonalization. So every mode is independent of every other mode. It turns out that the effect of putting L, a wall, and integrating out the rest does not produce interaction. So there are a set of modes where the vacuum becomes a density, direct product of modes, which are not populated 1 or 0, but they are populated depending on the energy. On the energy function. Once you have done that, you can compute exactly the reduced density matrix entropy, and you see it is done in terms of those populations of these peculiar modes, and you end up with this equation. And that's it. No more technical things for the computation. So look at that. You remember I asked you to remember that the maximum entropy was n, was a linear. Look at how it works. You see, n would be something, so you are far from a linear behavior. So what you're seeing is a concave formula, as we expected, which is all the time getting softer and softer. We are seeing a logarithmic behavior. Indeed, this is the result that you get. The entropy at the quantum phase transition, which is a measure of entanglement, scales when you scan the system as a logarithm. So you have a log of L. And now the coefficient, I write it as C over 3, and I compute for the three theories I showed you before, that is the quantum missing chain, the XY, the XX, or the Heisenberg, and I see 1/2, 1/2, 1, and 1. And this is the emergence of universality. You see, we are discovering that the entropy of the reduced density matrix obeys a universal scaling law. What different theories change is just the coefficient of the scaling law. And this C is what detects that you are talking about a free fermion or about a free boson. Mm-hmm. You see, let me rephrase that. The logarithmic scaling of the entropy is controlled by C, and this C is called the central charge. So behind my detailed model with the interactions which are finally dependent on the regulator, when I go to quantum phase transition, the details of the regulator vanish, and a scaling law emerges. That's universality. Very nice. Okay? So we have managed to find universal scaling for one figure of merit of entanglement, which was, in a way, what we wanted in the beginning. Now you may have many questions. What is a central charge? Was it known? Do we know more things beyond central spin chains? What do we know about all these things? And here we go. The first thing is that, indeed, the central charge is a fundamental piece in 1 plus 1 dimensional field theories. 1 plus 1 because 1 is time, which is given always for granted, and 1 is the spin chain. So in 1 plus 1 field theories at the critical point, these are called conformal field theories, and it is very nice because it has been set up a complete attack to these theories which is not depending on the Hamiltonians. So this goes back to the operator product expansion of Wilson and says that the complete characterization of a theory can be done at the level of an algebra of operators in that theory. So, if you think of spin chains, the sigma operator is one of the operators. But there is a maximum set of operators that completely characterizes the theory. Call it OI. So now this I stands for all the operators in the theory. The operator per expansion says that these operators close an algebra. And the algebra is OI OJ. It is closing a power law with the identity operator plus any other combination of the rest of the operators. That's an algebra. And the powers here are called scaling dimensions. So in the operator per expansion, it's a very high level presentation of a theory. It goes beyond Lagrangians and Hamiltonians. It simply tells you what is the absolute content of the theory. And this is due to Wilson when he invented the renormalization group and so on. So what makes a special 1 plus 1 dimension is that if you are at the phase transition, you recover scaling variance. And it can be proven, it was proven in 1970 by Polyakov, that you also recover a larger group of symmetry, which is the conformal group. So it turns out that the symmetry suddenly is immense. So there are infinitely many generators in 1 plus 1 dimension when you are at a critical point. And that all these operators can be classified. And this is a fundamental result of the 80s. In particular, if you take the energy momentum tensor of the theory, its algebra is like that, just like this one, and the coefficient you get here is the so-called central charge. So what I showed you before is that the entropy scaling is controlled by the central charge, which is the number you get in the operator per expansion of two energy momentum tensors. This is very nice, because of all the points that characterize the field theory in this Wilsonian view, you would talk about H, anomalous dimensions, or structural constants, Cs. Well, What can the entropy depend on? It cannot depend on the detail of the operators of the theory. It cannot. Okay, it's too fundamental a figure of merit to depend on whether I had a spin 1/2 or whatever. So it only depends on the only operator which is always defined in a field theory, and this is the energy momentum tensor. So if you give me any theory, I tell you in advance that there is one operator I can always construct, the energy momentum tensor. So the central charge which is related to it is the only member which is independent on all the details of the operators, and that's the one that has come to the entropy, which again is a very, I think, elegant fact. Every theory has an energy momentum tensor because it's a universal response to a change of the geometry. Any theory can be coupled to gravity. Any response of any theory is controlled by the energy momentum tensor. Now, we go back to more quantum information way of thinking. It turns out that away from the critical point, you can recompute this entropy, and the surprise is that it doesn't scale. It saturates. Depending on the magnetic field, you may have a different saturation line, but it never grows. So scaling is just possible at the critical point. So scaling of the entropy is a signature that you are at the phase transition. Quantum phase transitions are characterized by the scaling. Away from the quantum phase transition, there is no scaling. Moreover, if you take the number of spins n halves and they go to infinity, you can check that this is the way you characterize the entropy. Again, the central charge is controlling the deformations away from the critical point. Connection to previous work from high energy physics, from black holes. The first time this was computed was in 1993 by Shrinicki, who had in mind a very peculiar problem. People were discussing what was the entropy of a black hole. Well, we have Hawking here, we could go and talk to him. And he would tell us that it was very messy. Because what was the origin of the Bekenstein entropy? What is it? It's entanglement? So some people thought maybe the origin of Bekenstein entropy is simply that you have field theories and the vacuum is entangled and the black hole simply imposes a boundary that you cannot check. Therefore, you have to describe your system, your site of the universe, outside the black hole with the density matrix, not with the pure state. Now, if there is a density matrix, there is entropy. So might it be that the entanglement entropy is responsible for the Bekenstein entropy? And the first people to compute something was Shrinicki, who took a set of harmonic oscillators and he integrated out a few of them. He did it on a field theory rather than on a set of harmonic oscillators, but in the discretized version, it amounts to a set of harmonic oscillators. These computations was taken over by John Preskill, one of the people in the quantum information physics efforts, Fiola Strominger and Trivedi, Strominger, who made the computation with deep brains, maybe you know, and they use a completely different approach. They said, same idea, but I compute using all my knowledge of general relativity. So I use clever coordinates to make my computation transparent. They use what it is called Ringler coordinates. And they got the same result. And finally, you have Kallang, Holse, Larsen, and Wilczek, who define the analog of what we are doing. They said, look, I forget about all these things. Take a conformal field theory, integrate out a piece of it. We call that geometric entropy to make it clear that we are not attempting to discuss Bekenstein entropy. And they got the same result. So those three computations, all of them do not belong to the realm of quantum information because never there were qubits there. Never there was a cutoff implicit in the system itself. There were field theory computations. A second comment is that now we understand much better why density matrix renormalization group is not working in more than one space dimension. In one dimension, the entropy scales with a log. A log is an increase, but the maximum entropy was a power n. So So having a log is a moderate increase. So we can handle this amount of entropy, this amount of superpositions, and that's why it is possible to devise a method. It was possible for White to devise a method called density matrix renormalization group that was efficient. So that would could handle, in polynomial time, a system with n qubits. Okay? But if you go to more than one dimension, as you will see now, it is not possible. So let me make my third comment here. The area law, the famous area law of black holes, which is the same as you get from quantum information. The idea is that you have party A, party B. This is a bunch, a piece of your universe. This is the rest of it. Now, remember the basic property of entanglement of the entropy, that the entropy seen by A is identical to the entropy seen by B. This is the theorem that comes from the Schmidt decomposition. But if A has no access to B, and B has no access to A, what else can it be but a function of the surface that separates A and B? But A is separated from B by the area law in three dimensions. So the coming of the area law that was proposed for black holes is natural, it's inherent to the Schmidt decomposition. And this argument was already made by Schwenicki. You can find it in his paper. The area law that has been discussed for black holes has nothing to do with the fact that geometry is dynamical. Nothing. It has nothing to do with quantum gravity. It's a fact of quantum information. Okay? It's a fact that if you ignore a piece of the universe, what I get from the other, so the entropy, my entanglement, simply is a function of the area.
Though the area law itself doesn't have anything to do with gravity, but the proportionality factor,
correct,
one of the Planck lengths squared, is intimately related to gravity and the existence of a cutoff at the Planck.
Correct. So, let me say in my next transparency, I wanted to just one comment before your comment, which is that this is not correct because of the connectivity issue, which I will discuss now. And here it comes. So, I will come in two transparencies to your comment, which is absolutely correct. Now, let me give you a hint of why we have an area law based on more quantum information ideas. This is your system. It is full of qubits. Okay? They are on a network. Now, there is a representation of any state. So the representation I'm giving is dense, which is called valence bond, and it is very old. That says that this can be represented in a very clever way. You simply take the qubit, the physical Hilbert space here, and you represent with two ancillary Hilbert spaces. Now, what I do is that on this right side of my ancillary system, I put a bond or an EPR, or maximally entangled state, with the next one. Of course, if this is my new system, it would be a product of EPR state, which is not the ground state of my system. What I need is to make a projection that goes from the Hilbert space combined of these two into the physical Hilbert space, called this matrix A, the one that acts as a projector. And I argue now that if the system is translational invariant, the A's for every qubit are the same. So I simply represent an infinite system with this matrix. That's very efficient. That has been used in condensed matter for many years. Those I call entanglement bonds. Now let's see what is the effect of tracing out a piece of your space. So I eliminate this piece of the space. Well, you see, I'm just cutting these bonds. And how many bonds I cut? Well, the area that surrounds your system. So the area law is just coming from the number of bonds you're cutting. Now, this is a function of the fact that that representation is good. Okay? And translational symmetry. So I'm adapting to the geometry of two dimensions. Okay? You will hear this in much more detail, I think, in Plenius' talk, and also in Frank's talk, where they have used these in extremely clever ways to go much beyond what condensed matter people have done. Now, this is your point, Seth. The area law. The area law is okay, but what about the coefficient? Now, if you think a little bit, the entropy is dimensionless. So if I have L, I must have some other physical quantity that takes out the dimensions. So in a way, the area law is telling you that it scales with a given power if the unit of area is measured in a given way. In a field theory, this is typically the regulator. In quantum gravity, the Planck scale is what gives you the unit of surface. So the scaling, the Bekenstein scaling, contains two pieces. The natural scaling of the area law, which is quantum information based, and a second, which is what is the natural area in the theory, and this is the Planck area. This C1, I've written C1 to be consistent with the papers of these people. Well, this C1 is, I won't enter, but it's one of the terms in the effective action when you couple your theory to a gravitational background. So if you integrate all your matter fields, there is left an effective theory in terms of gravity. One of the coefficients is C1. So it is characterized, and if you are curious, this connects with the world of trace anomalies, and also it tells you that C1 is 1/6 for bosons and 1/12 for every degree, fermionic degree of freedom. I jump over this. Well, you see, I keep all the time going out from quantum information, coming back to quantum information, going out, coming back. Well, now I want to make something better. I want to use all this approach to do something better than whatever has been done in all the fields. And little by little, I will try to convince you that there is hope to really make outstanding progress. Okay? So the first is I will be a good friend of my friend, who is Vidal, Guifré Vidal, at Caltech, will tell you that he proved a theorem that I like very much that relates this figure of entanglement with the efficiency of a computation. Okay? So let me just tell you what he did. First I state the theorem, and then I just give a glimpse of how it works. The idea is that you take the register of your quantum computer, and you compute all the possible Schmidt decompositions in part A and B, where A and B are contiguous. So I take 1 versus n minus 1, 2 versus n minus 2, and so on. And I compute what is the maximum of all these partitions. Well, the theorem states that if chi, which is, again, the maximum Schmidt number of all the possible partitions, if chi is polynomially bounded, then he produces an efficient simulation. Okay? So I said it again. If the register has maximum chi polynomially bounded, much less than exponential, then there is a classical efficient representation of the state, so I don't need a large memory in my computer. And on top, all the 1 and 2 qubit gates can be performed efficiently. You see, by the contrary, either there is a lot of entanglement, or otherwise, this small or slight entanglement can be simulated efficiently. So we need a lot of entanglement in the quantum computer for these operations not to be simulated in a classical computer. Entanglement is what we cannot simulate easily. And now, just a hint, the idea is very basic. Substitute the naive idea of keeping your computer the coefficients of the state, which are 2 to the n, okay? Substitute that initial and naive idea by a more clever idea, which is keep all along the Schmidt decompositions, these values of the partition 1, n minus 1, and then these are changes of matrices between the basis that diagonalize the first decomposition and the basis that diagonalize the second decomposition. Now, if entanglement is reduced, all these numbers, alphas, will go only to a small number. So I will represent all these coefficients, 2 to the n, by a polynomial number of entities. Very clever. And on top, the theorem is completed with the fact that single and 2 qubit gates are explicitly shown to be efficient. Now, this has produced a new algorithm which is extremely efficient for chains. It simulates time evolution, it computes ground states, it competes with density matrix normalization group essentially at the same level. Well, I said already, at the same level. So what happens is that these kind of algorithms have been proven to be at the same quality level that the best that was known before. Just that we have arrived to them through the idea of keeping entanglement rather than the coefficients of the registers. Here, I stopped and I want for a second, and I want to tell you that this is the holy grail of condensed matter. If you are able to extend whatever representation of your states and computations to more than chains, so that is networks, you see, this has been tried by an enormous community for decades. Okay? So if you manage, it works. And I think I'm very pleased because Ignacio and Frank have already produced, I think, the first efficient algorithm in in higher dimensions. This, I think, is a fantastic progress. Okay, it's fantastic. I mean, you come to a problem that was there for 30 years, new ideas, new insight, faff, you produce something new. Giffre is also having some results along these lines. So you see, we have gone a step beyond. Now, let me tell you a few other things about entanglement in quantum computation. The first is Roman, who is here, made the clever observation that if you take the Shor's algorithm and you stop and you consider just the register here after the unitary huge operation before the quantum Fourier transform, and you look at the register, you can see that the Schmidt number is R, where R is the period of the number you are trying to find. This is very, very cute, because it says that your quantum algorithm will use little entanglement if the period is small. But if the period is large, it will use a vast entanglement. So it is telling you that I could have done it otherwise. I could have tried periods, 1, 2, 3, 4. That would be an efficient way of doing it. But the difficult period finding is when R is very large. And the computer simply uses as much entanglement as needed. That's very nice. Then, 3SAT. As you know, 3SAT is the anti-complete problem that defines the class. It is a problem where you have to find a string of bits such that they verify a number of clauses, of 3-bit clauses. It's complete. We know, well, you know, there are an enormous amount of knowledge about this model. And you also know that there are efforts in quantum information to attack this problem with quantum algorithms. What I will try to tell you is that now we have something to say. If you give me your proposal for 3SAT, you come very happy. I have an algorithm for 3SAT. Here you have. Okay, I will do something. I will check whether along your computation entanglement goes very high. If not, keep it. Because I know this is similar, I can simulate it with my classical computer. And therefore, we don't need a quantum computer. And I doubt, or many people doubt, that there is a classical algorithm for that. So either your algorithm, your proposal algorithm, scales, the entropy scales very high, or I don't believe that you are in good shape. So that's what we did for the adiabatic theorem. You see, we're a little bit bad with our friend Eddie, because my proof, the only thing I can do is to kill the algorithm. I cannot prove it. I can kill it. And so that's what we did. The idea is you take a Hamiltonian, which is known, initial Hamiltonian, the prime Hamiltonian that encodes the solution of the 3SAT instance, and you do adiabatic evolution from one to the other. And you all know how it works. The mass gap, the energy gap has to be polynomial only, not exponentially small. And you can build the polynomial or the clause Hamiltonian assigning adequately these plus and minus signs. Okay. You do that. You do a simulation. And typically you find the following. You find that the energy gap at some point along the computation becomes very small. Whether it's polynomially small or exponentially small is what matters. Lacking a proof, you do simulations, and simulations so far go up to 20. In our little computers, 21. In other computers, have gone farther away. And at the level where you compute, you see 1 over n law. This is plotting the gap versus 1 over n. You see sort of a straight line. But this is no evidence, of course. First of all, you have to remember that it's in the worst case that it has to succeed. So these are these little other points. So whether the minimum of the worst case gaps are exponentially small is what matters. Now, this is numerically impossible to make an assessment. But we can do the following. We can check the scaling of the entropy. And lo and behold, it's amazing. It's universal. So if you go and you try instances and instances, you see that entanglement measure as the reduced density matrix entropy simply is zero, then wow. At some point along the computation, the computer suddenly becomes completely entangled, the register. Now, always at the same point, always higher and higher as you increase the number of qubits, so entanglement is a scaling. How much it is a scaling? Here it is, as a linear power. So it's fantastic that entanglement scales as the maximum power possible. So, point to n. This brings the first glimpse of the picture. Spin change away from the critical point, entropy is constant. Spin change at critical point, entropy goes as a log. Spin networks, area law, the entropy goes as d minus 1, which is the area, and n 1 over d is taking the length of the sphere. And finally, NP-complete problems, numerically we see it goes as n. So NP-complete problems are the farthest systems, the systems with larger entanglement possible that I know. It's a maximum they can have. Well, what we have achieved, we have achieved... Oh, you wanted me to finish. Can I? Okay. I was thinking of the hour. We have cleaned out our understanding of entropy. We have rephrased limitations of density matrix. And we have focused on entanglement. Okay, we have focus on entanglement. Now, let me tell you that on top, I think we can now produce a good step forward. We can now think that maybe it's entanglement what is the heart of renormalization. So what you're doing is changing the way you represent correlations along the renormalization group flow. So the idea is that renormalization group flows maybe the sign of the loss of information, that is, the loss of quantum information. And to show you that, I will give you examples that, indeed, for this model, there is global loss of entanglement, there is monotonic loss of entanglement. Not only the ultraviolet point and the infrared have lost entanglement, but it is losing monotonically, and on top, that there is a fine grain, an extremely subtle way where entanglement is being lost. We go along this line. The first is a triviality. If this is the law at fixed points, there is something called the C theorem that says that the central charge is always smaller in the end of the renormalization group flow. Well, then automatically we have lost. So the entropy is immediately proven to obey this rule. Second, monotonic. We compute it. Here is the plot. We know that for the spin change, the renormalization flow is increasing lambda or going to zero. And indeed, the entropy monotonically goes down in both directions. And third, take L, take the density matrix, voila. So at every step, of the renormalization group, you compute rho L. So rho L at T step, and you go to a step beyond T prime, we have computed that, and you see that there is strict majorization. So there are 2 to the n equations being fulfilled along the renormalization group. There is a loss of entanglement, which is fine grain. Every body in the eigenvalues know what it has to do. My 2 last comments. One has to do with new efforts we are doing with Giffre and Enrique and Lutgen. Is that new people have entered the game. Cardi, one of the founders of conformal field theory. And he produced recently an explicit formula for the eigenvalues of rho L in the quantum easing model and the XX chain. Well, we have been able to take these eigenvalues and exactly show exact majorization analytically now. No numerically, analytically. Okay? We have also produced efficient computations for theory which are not the standard fermion and boson using the algorithm of Giffre. And a second set of results is this conundrum related to connectivity. So what is that makes the area law or what law? So we thought maybe why don't we analyze a peculiar system like the Lipkin model, a model proposed in the 60s to describe nuclear interactions, where everybody interacts with everybody. So spin I with J, all of them. Everybody is interacting with everybody. Now you would say that now the connectivity is very large. So maximum entropy here. No, because immediately the Hilbert space arranges itself on symmetric spaces, states, and whenever you have a Hilbert space made of symmetric states, the entropy gets bounded, because the number of superpositions is reduced. And this, indeed, can be proven to be a lock, and indeed we have checked that this model, although the connectivity is very large, has so much symmetry that, again, the entropy is reduced. So the entropy is a mixture of connectivity and symmetry in your model. I finish here saying that I think that quantum information has produced really fresh new ideas in these fields. You see, we are in the verge of seeing efficient simulations in two dimensions. Hubble model, superconductivity, all these things could be now addressed, and this is a major progress. And we are fighting very hard to bring the traditional RGE understanding on Hamiltonians a la Wilson, or on correlators, as it has been done in many other in different fields, we want to bring it down to states. So we want to bring RGE to states. And we want to understand what's there. And this we are pursuing with Ignacio and Frank, and hopefully we will find the deep idea that RGE irreversibility would relate to a loss of quantum information at the level of states. And that's it.
So it's interesting. I mean, your talk is, I think it's really great that you're working on these problems related to statistical mechanics. And mm-hmm. I hope that the people in statistical mechanics appreciate this work. But I think it's one thing that's quite nice is that you show by looking your treatment of adiabatic quantum computing shows you why there are certain problems in two-dimensional systems that are hard. I mean, if you wish to embed a problem like 3SAT or any of these NP-complete problems into a actual physical quantum system, so for instance, you might want to construct it using superconducting system, then that system has to be two-dimensional, because otherwise you can't get the kind of frustration which corresponds to the constraints of the system. And then in these systems, when they're as you pointed out, at their critical point, the system is entirely entangled, which means that these renormalization group methods fail. And the other point is because you know that you can embed an actual quantum computation in such a two-dimensional system, in ground state of such a two-dimensional system, then you can prove that, in fact, calculating for arbitrary two-dimensional systems, calculating what happens in them is as hard as performing a generic quantum computation. Which is kind of bad news if you want a simple.
It's bad news. I agree completely. We have proven in a way, or we have found evidence that doing an arbitrary quantum computation of an NP-complete problem is translating this problem into the simulation of a very specific phase transition.
Yeah.
So that matches in both directions. If you have an efficient a phase transition in higher dimensions, it is a hard problem. If you have an NP-complete, because it's like that. So your quantum register is like a system approaching a phase transition, but a very specific one. You know that one. That's why it is extremely complicated. Now you know from Eddie maybe that they have computed many little things along the adiabatic computation, and they for instance, whether the qubit decides to go to one or zero, it's decided at that point, at the same point where the phase transition takes place. at that point, the quantum register becomes a high, an enormous superposition of everybody, and there decisions are taken. You go up, you go down, and little by little, puff. So it's a quantum phase transition. So, very nice.
Do you have like numerical results on how your measure of entanglement compares to some other more standard methods?
Well, in these systems, some people have used the concurrence, but concurrence, you cannot do something like a scaling, because as you go to two second nearest neighbors, they decay too fast. And so actually, I think that beyond this measure of entanglement, all the other ideas have to do with correlators. But do you have any measure in mind that I'm missing?
I'm just trying to get an idea if for a given system your method provides for the measurement of entanglement for a given system, how the values that you obtain from the entropy will compare to some other value obtained from some other method.
Like what? Do you have in mind some other measure of entanglement?
No, but like the few that you mentioned at the beginning, that they are more standard and they depend on the parameters.
I think you cannot compute them explicitly for these systems. You see, measures of traditional measures of entanglement, formation, distillation, and so on, how do you measure for these systems?
Just wanted to make sure, I know the answer, but I wanted to make sure that these conjectures about like the scaling of the entropy for NP-complete problems, those are based on simulations, right?
I hope I made it clear, yes.
Okay, because whenever you see a table with scales as N,
That's correct. I mean, all the other entries in the table were analytical, except for the last one, which was numerical.
See, this is very interesting because is there hope from other branches of physics of finding some kind of a bound like this? For example, the simulation that you're doing is particular to this kind of adiabatic computing. So you fix an algorithm, or you fix a system and then you perform simulations, right? What we would ideally like to find would be, like, no matter how you encode the problem, no matter how you want to solve the problem, there is a lower bound of this kind. Now, see, that dimension is lacking in any branch of physics.
But I would like to insist on Giffre's result that either entanglement scales or otherwise I have an efficient simulation. Okay? So, if there were any other method to solve the problem where you wouldn't have this scaling of entanglement, then the three-step problem would be efficiently solved. Okay? So be careful.
I know. Yeah. Just hoping.
But I don't understand why would you suggest that the fact that there is a large entanglement will help solve SAT?
Solve what? Sorry?
Will help solve SAT satisfiability.
No. I think I made it clear that it is something necessary, not sufficient. I made clear that the only purpose of the effort was whether we could kill the method. Because if there was no scaling, then forget it. But there is no... Obviously, you are not proving anything like that.
Can you say anything about scaling of entanglement at phase transitions at finite temperature?
Well, I haven't worked myself on that. But the idea is that you get a competition of two entanglement lengths, I guess. One coming from quantum mechanics and another coming from thermal activation. And at some regimes, one dominates over the other. So the system would be dominated by the shortest of the two correlation lengths. So either thermal fluctuation may kill the correlators or entangle or the other. So you would play in the parameter space, and if you are too far from the critical point, quantum correlations would decrease by themselves. If you are at the temperatures that kill correlation, would be the same. So although it is a possibility, I don't think you gain any insight in that. Mm-hmm.
Could you please elaborate on what do you mean by extension to higher dimensions, and why will it be an important change?
Well, you know that spin chains Imagine your better computer in your university. How many qubits can you simulate? 24.
But higher dimension means that instead of qubits, you
go to... No, qubits, but set up, the interactions are set up on a two-dimensional grid. Okay. So you see, with 25 is 5 times 5. So the most you can simulate strictly is 5 times 5. What you want is 200 times 200. Okay? So whereas a line of 25, you get something decent. And because entanglement is logarithmic, on a plane. But I think Frank will tell you a lot about that.
I think we should wind it up at this point because we're running over it in length. And I'm sure that Jose will engage you for the lunch. Let's thank him again for his talk. I'd like to remind you again about the procedures for lunch. If you're a registered paid-up